Beauty Pop, the show that'll keep you in the know about popular Hollywood trends in fashion, fitness, makeup, hair care, and skincare. Keeping it real and coming straight from the heart. Hi there, I'm your host, Melina Gay, and welcome to Beauty Pop.
Well, hey there, everyone. This is Melina Gay, and you are listening to Beauty Pop Live. And this week's color of the week is turquoise. Now, turquoise is the name of a greenish-blue color and is based on the gem of the same name. The word turquoise comes from the French for Turkish, as the gem was originally imported from Turkey. The first recorded use of turquoise as a color name in English was in 1573. Now, the meaning of the color turquoise is refreshing, feminine, calming, sophisticated, energetic, wisdom, serenity, wholeness, creativity, and emotional stability is what it represents. In color psychology, turquoise controls and heals the emotions, creating emotional balance and stability. It's a combination of blue and a small amount of yellow. It fits in the color scale between green and blue. It radiates the peace, calm, and tranquility of blue and the balance and growth of green with the uplifting energy of yellow. Turquoise helps to open the lines of communication between the heart and the spoken word. Turquoise is a color that recharges our spirits during times of mental stress and tiredness, alleviating feelings of loneliness. Turquoise presents as a friendly and happy color, symbolizing the enjoyment of life. You only have to focus on the color turquoise, whether on a wall or clothing, and you can feel instant calm and gentle invigoration, ready to face the world again. So whether it's in jewelry or blouse or shirt, turquoise is it this week. All right, for turquoise. And now our next segment is Melina Says. And this week's segment of Melina Says, I say stay protected from the big bad sun with sunscreen. Now, it's so important, whether you're in California where there is sun all year round or in various parts of the world where you only have excessive radiations of sun for certain times of the year, whatever it is you want to be sure that you're definitely protected with sunscreen. And so what you want to do, and here are four common sunscreen mistakes, and beware. Number one, taking sides. Now, some people unintentionally apply less sunscreen to their non-dominant side. So that's meaning if you're right-handed, you tend to go lighter on the left side. So just be sure to apply it evenly to achieve the protection that is specified on the bottle with the SPF. Number two, skipping spots. Now, believe it or not, dermatologists see many precancerous lesions around the hairline and above the lips because people tend to generally skip over those spaces and just don't pay as much attention as the forehead or your cheeks. So please be sure to pay special attention, again, around the hairline and above the lips. Number three, avoiding the eyes. Now, you want to definitely avoid, as much obviously, avoid your pupil and your eyeball. But to reduce stinging even around the sensitive eye area, try dabbing sunscreen around the eyes instead of rubbing it. And then switch to a gentle version, too, if that doesn't work. And number four, a big common mistake, relying on foundation. Now, we women, we often don't even wear enough makeup to get the SPF on the label because we're so busy trying to make it look natural. And so we don't put on the amount that we should to get what the SPF is on the bottle, or we don't apply it all over our face. I'm guilty of that, too. I might apply it, you know, more heavily around my eye area and kind of leave the cheeks area there. Well, that's not good because then you're not happy, you're not getting any coverage on your cheekbone area. So for the most even coverage, apply sunscreen on your face first with a foundation brush. And then you're sure to get in all those nooks and crannies around your eyes and around the nose and keep your face very, very protected. Okay, well, that's it for this week's edition of Melina Says, Stay Protected with Sunscreen. And we'll be right back with our very special guest, the fabulous Superwoman, Tadia Rice.
Crystal Coral Seas is a fine gemstone jewelry line that authenticates and promotes a collection of high-quality jewelry that is exclusive to the Melina brand.
The Melina Gay Signature Collection is a process of the knowledge that has been obtained from many years of jeweled artisan experience and international travel. Unique to most jewelry collections, the MGSC staff travels the world to obtain the best quality gemstones at the most affordable prices while keeping up with the latest styles.
All of Melina's pieces from her custom signature collection have been designed and created by experienced hand crafters. This allows all of the exquisite and unique pieces the options of making any adjustments or refinements, thereby creating an even more personalized custom piece.
For your next memorable moment, MGSC. Available at LL's Consignment Boutique, located at 1205 North La Brea in Inglewood.
And welcome to a beauty supplement drink that helps revive you from the inside out.
And welcome back to Beauty Pop. Melina Gay Signature Collection is also available at MelinaGaySignatureCollection.com. Welcome back to Beauty Pop. Today's special guest is the superwoman, Tadia Rice. Thank you. Welcome, Tadia.
Thank you, Melina. It's so nice to be with you. Is that applause?
I know you're fabulous. Welcome to Beauty Pop. I know you're fabulous, and I'm going to let everyone else know exactly how fabulous you are right now. Now, Tadia Rice has enjoyed a lengthy, successful business career. When she had already enjoyed that when she decided to transition to author, playwright, and recording artist. Her essay entitled Breaking Into the Boys Club is a personal account of her experience as the only female in the all-male business environment in 1970 affirmative action America. Tadia is a motivational speaker in demand. Her debut CD, Solace of the Eyes, and the lush original cast recording of the music drama, A Woman and Her Words, competed for Grammy nominations in 10 categories. Now, I'm going to go on and on and on about Tadia, but I just want to stop here for a moment. Tadia, I was intrigued. Just 10 nominations in 10 categories, that is absolutely outstanding.
Well, it was a big surprise to both myself and my co-producer, Ellis Hall. We didn't expect it. It was our first effort, and certainly my first effort as a recording artist, but we submitted and we were able to compete for nominations. And I am very proud to say that I lost to Elton John for the music drama that we produced, and I lost to Aida, which is one of my favorite plays. So I was very proud of that.
Oh, well, that's quite an accomplishment because, you know, the win is in the nomination. The win is in the nomination. And even if you consider it, that is just fantastic. Wow. So now you said, now that was just your debut CD.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Right.
You've done more since then. Can you tell us what has inspired you to enter the world of entertainment, even though you are still currently a motivational speaker and now a fabulous author?
So, oh, well, performing really kind of happened accidentally to me, and I guess that the destiny kicked in, and that's where it took me. I had really resisted for many, many years being an artist, you know, and finally I couldn't escape it. So I was an accidental playwright because I was so inspired by this woman whose name was Tahereh, who was the very first woman in the world to remove her face veil in the 1800s in the ancient land of then Persia. And she was a great poet and a legal scholar, and when I read her translated poetry, when it first went into English, I was just captivated, and that led me then down this path of creativity that I had not anticipated.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, so now her life has been documented by the play that I created, which was a 7-character play, and it went around the world for 10 years and inspired many, many people, and I was very, very happy about that. Because that's what every artist, I think, really wants to do, is inspire others by their creation.
Exactly, especially when their stories of true life,
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Through it, just feel so much like, wow, I didn't just do this. Hopefully it will help and inspire others.
Right, because she was this remarkable woman far ahead of her time. She's actually called Joan of Arc of the East because she stood up for her beliefs. She called for the end of slavery. She called for religious freedoms and for independence investigation of truth. You know, in a time and place when women really were no more than chattel in that society, and really around the world, even in America, women were fighting for the vote and still didn't get it for another 50 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's. Thank you for what you did. Now, are you, and I'm sure you've had to have gotten tremendous rave reviews, and just in talking to you about it now, I'm inspired and excited. I want to get to see it. So are you going to do a revival of it? Are you going to
I don't know. I just do not know. The CDs are available, of course, on Amazon and CD Baby, and even on the site that commemorates this woman's life, the TahereAssociation.org, which is all about carrying on Tahereh's legacy to educate women and help those who are agents of change in their community. So under the Tahereh Association, you can also order the CDs. But it's easy to find. Just Google Tadia, T-A-D-I-A, and my CDs will come up, Tadia Rice, as well as my website for my business speaking site. So I do have those two. And I just returned from South Africa, by the way, just about a week ago to the United States after being able to witness the 20th anniversary of democracy in that country, which was very significant for me because I'd been there in 1994 and was an international observer for the first democratic election. So to now come back after even having lived there for 15 years, to come back after a five-year absence was wonderful because I could see what 20 years of democracy can actually do to a nation.
Wow. And what were some of the things that you observed? Like, what were some of the some of the things that were just as different that you wouldn't have even expected?
I think for me, it was the young people who are called born frees, that were born, you know, within these last 20 years. They never knew what apartheid was. They have been free all their lives. There was never an issue for them in terms of opportunity or school or education or freedom of movement. And so their view of the world is so very different than that of their parents or grandparents, who, of course, suffered through apartheid. And it doesn't matter if they were African or Afrikaner or English or Indian or colored, you know, according to the old apartheid system, that distinction still exists there. They have a whole different view of the world and of South Africa and of Africa, and they're very committed to making their place, not just on that continent, but really globally. They believe they can, they are committed to it, and I'm just so excited about it because that's what Africa needs. It needs to see beyond its own borders. It needs to see itself as a world player. And these young ones are the ones who are going to do that.
Yes, they are. And yes, it does. Yes, it does. Have you, aside from the people, have you seen any, aside from the younger people, have you seen an attitudinal change, even with the older, the people who have been there, you know, have you seen... Has it been a gradual, and I know you've gone for 5 years, but do you see it as a gradual acceptance, or has it just been an all-out embrace of what the new world order is over there?
Well, you know, apartheid was very insidious, and it was 300 years of incredible racism, you know, to the depths of, you know, I would say similar to American slavery. I mean, the heinousness of it was horrid. And it has been, for some, gradual, for others, a little bit easier, depending on what their position was during that time. There were a lot of people who didn't believe in apartheid but didn't have exposure to actually see the results of it. So they were kind of ignorant. They knew it was there, but they didn't really know what it looked like. So those people were able to make a faster transition. There were those, however, who did not want a black government, did not want to see Nelson Mandela free, and who really resisted. And they essentially had to say, well, either I accept this change or I leave, and they left. And it's good that they did, because they would have only obstructed the progress that was made. But, you know, I would say that in a way South Africans are much further ahead than Americans in dealing with race relations. Americans tend to sweep their feelings under the rug. We like to claim that America is a melting pot, a salad bowl, and that we're so willing to embrace and accept people who are different than we are. But I don't really see that. When you go to American high school campuses now, kids still are segregated in how they eat lunch. You know, you have the Asians at a table, you have the black kids at a table, the Hispanics are at another table, the whites are at another table. So, you know, I don't know that we've come very far. Whereas in South Africa, people would say, you know, I was raised to dislike you, to hate you, to think that, you know, you were not worthy. I realize now that was wrong, and I want to learn more about you and your culture, and let's find unity in our differences. And that's very genuine and very sincere in South Africa. So for that, I think they're further ahead than we are. They deal with their prejudice. They know their prejudice. And they say, look, I didn't grow up, you know, I didn't think it was right to associate with you. Now I know it's fine to associate with you.
Wow. Wow. That they really are more evolved than us here in America. So now let me ask you, is this what your book is going to be about? And when can we anticipate being able to read? I've read on your blog post that the things that transpired even as you were getting over there with security at the airport and just so many things happening in this wonderful journey. So can you tell us a little bit more about what is going to be, what we can anticipate in this great literary masterpiece?
Well, I hope it will be some kind of masterpiece. At least my grandkids might think so. It's really my 50 years with Mandela. It's my 50 years with South Africa. I was in high school when I learned about the Rivonia trial, the year that it occurred. And ironically, it was at such an impressionable time in my life. I was a teenager. I was 15, and I said, this is horrible, this thing called apartheid, and I'm going to work the rest of my life to end it because it's just horrible. And never thinking in those days that I would actually see the end of it, never, ever thinking I would meet Nelson Mandela or any of the other Rivonia trialists, who I've met them all at this point, never thinking I was going to see justice prevail. And over the many years, you know, not only did I witness it, I was part of it, I helped live the history, I witnessed the history, and it's been 50 years, ironically. And with Madiba's death last December, it was like, okay, I guess I really need to talk about what I've learned on this adventure as an activist, as a corporate warrior, as one who, even while at Xerox and GE, would stand up and say, here, sign this petition. And I mean, I was very well known for being quite radical in the corporate world. But so it's really my story, my memoirs, my time with Mandela, what I learned, how it changed me, what the transformative power was behind watching people who were willing to sacrifice their lives and get to know those people and why, and then take that step yourself when you say, yes, I'm willing to sacrifice mine too for what is good and right and righteous. So that's what the story is. All true.
Wow, Tadia, that's amazing. Now, I can tell you, I'm a little bit prejudiced because I'm on the board of directors of the Roby Theater Company, and so we love, love, love good theater, and this sounds like a fantastic play. It sounds like a wonderful music can emanate from it. I mean, you can do so many things with this story, but you have to write it first. So when can we anticipate it, and how can we read it?
Well, you know, I've got about 75% of the book done, and the purpose of this trip was to get the interviews that I wanted to get of those who are still living, who were imprisoned with Madiba, Those people who knew him well, knew him best, sacrificed with him, made their mark in the world. So I actually interviewed kind of from every class that I could find, from, farm workers and house helpers all the way to parliament members and people. The youngest person who was in Robben Island, who was 14 years old at the time that he was rounded up in just watching a student talk on campus, and he's rounded up and he ends up in Robben Island at 14 years old, all the way to Dennis Goldberg, who was one of the few white Rivona trialists who was convicted with Mandela and went to Pretoria prison for 22 years because he was white, so he couldn't go to Robben Island because that was just for colored or black or Indians. And the stories of sacrifice of all these people, or my friend Thandi Klabashi, whose father was the last elected Zulu chief, who really helped stop the South African government from executing Mandela and the rest of the Rivona trialists. And he pled with the United Nations because he was the first African Nobel laureate. He pled with them, please don't let South Africa kill these men. Give them life if you have to, but don't let them kill them. And indeed, behind the scenes, the UN did deal with the apartheid government, and they were convicted to 4 life terms each. And then Chief Luthuli, Albert Luthuli, was actually assassinated directly after that. And the impact on that family, what happened from then on, there's never been an elected Zulu chief again. It was always appointed by the apartheid government after that. So these stories are not just dramatic and they're just so inspiring and motivating because it really challenges our view of what reality is. We are so fortunate in this country. Most people would never have to think about that kind of, worrying about being assassinated or losing your father for really what's right. So the stories are incredible. They're just incredible. But it's those kind of people that make up that country, and that's why that country is so remarkable. That's why most countries are remarkable. It's the people.
It's the people, and it's the people such as yourself who want to visit and explore and tell those stories. And let me ask you this. You have such a diverse background, from being in corporate America to author to singer to motivational speaker. In all of that that you have accomplished, in addition to party crasher at the inauguration, but we'll keep that a secret.
with you, might I add.
yeah, that's what we do. but Jamie's okay with it, so we had a good time, and that was an important thing. But what is the most beautiful experience out of all of the wonderful things that you've done that you can say, either one or two, but the most beautiful that you can say?
Oh, there's so many. I think welcoming my 2 grandchildren into the world, loving them as babies, and then being able to watch them grow into whoever they're going to become, ever-changing, always exciting. They're an adventure to watch. so that was quite, that's quite beautiful when you actually can witness that. There certainly have been others, but some are momentous. I think being with Nelson Mandela right after he was released from prison in Namibia and watching the old South African flag go down as Namibia's new flag went up, and then being with him when he cast his vote for the first time in life in 1994, and then watching the new South African flag go up in South Africa at his inauguration when he became president. And then probably the most was being with him on December 31st, 1999, which was a Saturday night, welcoming the millennium in. And I was with him on Robben Island with a few hundred of the other Robben Islander inmates, who were by then, of course, parliament members and heading the government. His warm embrace that night was indescribable. And he thanked me for the anti-apartheid work I had done. He thanked me for helping him and the people of South Africa. And I was speechless. I mean, it was beyond humbling. His greatness was humbling. And he was even being humble. And I'd been with him many times, but that night was more intimate, more personal, was very spiritual. It was, you know, a change in the millennial date, and it was there where he'd been in prison. And it made me understand that you have to be humble when you're dealing with a spiritual giant. I felt like I was in the presence of a saint, really, even though he wasn't. He himself would always say he was just human. But he was such a godly man, especially as he aged. And everyone who ever met him or knew him would have this kind of experience with him. You just couldn't talk. He was overwhelming, overwhelming, loving, and wonderful.
Wow, wow. As I'm listening to you, I'm getting chills all over, just like, wow, it must have been to just have those experiences of such a great man and such an inspirational man, and just everything that he did and what he represented and symbolized and what he suffered for.
Yes.
For the betterment of his country, for the betterment of the people, is, you know, to be around, because there are very few people such as that, but to be around someone like that and be able to experience them, I know some of it had to rub off on you. It had to.
Well, I think he, anyone who ever dealt with him, they couldn't be untouched. He touched you, and that was just part of his greatness. But, you know, beauty is very much in the eye of the beholder. And for me, that was a beautiful time and moment. And it makes me think about what Khalil Gibran would say. He spoke of beauty, you know, in the book The Prophet, and we all know that book so well. But his words really inspired me. Can I share what the quotes are that I love so much about that?
Yes, please.
Gibran said, "Beauty is life when life unveils her holy face." And then he says, "You are life. Beauty is eternity gazing at itself in a mirror. You are eternity, and you are the mirror."
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
that's
Gibran was
beautiful.
A very wise man. So, you know, I think we're very fortunate to live in a time and a place where the world's borders are crumbling, and when we're beginning to see how much we are alike, no matter where we come from or who we are in this world. And that, to me, is the beauty of it all, is we are really beginning to recognize our oneness in this consciousness that the world is finally beginning to wake up and experience. So I really have to thank you, Melina, for what you are doing, because I'm just so impressed, you know, not just with this show, but the work that you do. It's really, you've taken beauty and given it a dimension that is certainly not external only, but far more enriching and important. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome, and I really appreciate that. That means a lot, especially coming from you, such a beautiful person on the inside, a beautiful person on the outside, and just I really appreciate that compliment. Thank you so much, Tadia.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, and that will conclude our show for this week, and you just gave us our quote of the week. Would you mind repeating it again for everyone? It's so wonderful.
Okay. In The Prophet, Khalil Gibran says on the chapter on beauty, and a little bit of this might be paraphrased, he says, "Beauty is life when life unveils her holy face. You are life. Beauty is eternity gazing at itself in a mirror. You are eternity, and you are the mirror."
I love it. And remember, there is no one way to be beautiful. Well, thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this edition of Beauty Pop. Thank you so much, Tadia, for joining us. And
thank
stay
you.
Tuned. You're welcome. And tune in next week, same time, same place, for another edition of Beauty Pop.
Only on Blog Talk Radio will you hear the celebrity host of Easy Way Broadcasting. Network owner Eric Easy Zuli treats his 500,000 Twitter followers to insider tips and connections on upcoming shows with the top celebrities and business leaders. Follow Eric at Hollywood It Guy and tune in 7 days a week to talk with the Easy Way Broadcasting show host at 914-338-1303. Visit www.easywaybroadcasting.com to advertise on the Easy Way Broadcasting Network.
This episode of Beauty Pop Live is brought to you by BeLadiesDesign.com. That's B-E-E, ladiesdesign.com. Also, VanityDrink.com. As always, you can follow Easy Way Broadcasting on Facebook. That's letter E, letter Z. For more exciting shows on Easy Way Broadcasting, catch us next week on Beauty Pop Live.